This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collett. Welcome to The First Time. Okay, Kate.
Hi, Catherine.
It's getting real. It's getting real.
I think so, the world's getting real, really,
oh
isn't
God.
It?
Life. Last episode was a bit doom and gloom, but this week we are picking ourselves back up and brushing ourselves off. I have invested in real milk.
Oh, my goodness. I've been waiting for the moment for you to...
It hasn't run out, but I'm feeling like I'm in the middle of lockdown. Really, the least I can do is have proper milk. So, hey...
Need proper milk
bottoms
right now.
Up. But I think some way more exciting things are happening to you, and I can see some of them in the background.
It's quite a full room in here currently in my precious little studio.
So the book comes out September 2.
It does.
Day of the readings launch for those who haven't yet signed up.
Absolutely.
Now, last episode, you mentioned a note of sadness that you didn't get to the Booktopia signing. What's happened since?
So that very afternoon, all was confirmed. That was even before we went into stage 4 lockdown, you know.
I think it was.
That. Anyway, so A, we're going to stage 4 lockdown. B, it's pretty clear that people in New South Wales don't want a bar of Victorians right now. So the good people at Booktopia sent me down some boxes of books, which was incredibly exciting. So let's talk about the silver lining here, which is that my kids got to be involved. One of them just thought it was boring as, but my youngest, who's just popping in here now.
I know this hand movement well. I was at work, and I think the one thing about lockdown is that the venom of my get out has mellowed over time. Like the first few times I was interrupted in a meeting, I was like that man on that Weather Channel or whatever who was interviewed and, you know, his wife is crawling in, pulling the child out. Whereas now it's a gentler get out of here, child.
Yes. But so my youngest, my seven-year-old was excited and did in fact unpack all the books
gorgeously
for me. Yeah.
And you have a slow time, what do they call it?
Time lapse. Yeah, we did time lapse.
Gorgeous.
Well, I needed it to be as close to the Booktopia experience as it could possibly be. I did try and get my husband, who is pretty good at bubble writing still, you know, left over from year 7.
Wow.
He enjoyed the bubble writing.
Quite a good skill to have.
I was going to ask him to do the Booktopia sign to stick up behind me, but that was a bit much. So we just, you know, we just did the time lapse. But yes, all very fun. But so now I've got the new lot of books from the next people has arrived. So it's all very.
So how many books are we talking? Like you literally, I can see at least,
there's 12
I would
boxes.
Say six or seven boxes. Okay, right. Boxes.
Me and the courier. I have a lot of steps. And, of course, in these current times, like these couriers are working hard. So, you know, I don't make them come up the steps
hard.
And there's children and so much air. So, so I've been bringing them up. That's been my workout. But, you know, it's fun. And then my amazing publishers are making some little book plates. As we discussed, we said we saw Natasha Lester
Gorgeous.
With them. So I'm getting them so that I can, you know, do personalised signings because that's what you want, right? Dear Jan. Enjoy.
Super. So have you got RSI?
No, I did go through a couple of Sharpies, but...
Sharpie is the pick of pens, I reckon.
Yep. You told me it needs to be a Sharpie. So I got a whole box of them, you know, just to be
lavish.
Really excited. You know, positive thinking is what you need when you're releasing a book into a state of disaster, Catherine, is what I've decided. Positive, the power of positive thinking.
It's a huge power. What else is going on? I see you've got something nice that you're wearing.
How gorgeous is it? So my birthday's in July. I wanted to buy myself a present. I have been checking out. You know those people you follow on Instagram, you're like, one day, one day I'll buy that thing. Yeah. I'll get that thing made. I'll buy that jacket. And Loris Clothing on Instagram just makes the most gorgeous hand-knitted jumpers. And I was like, you know what? Stuff it. I'm doing it. And so I'd kind of ordered one with her, and then she got really under the pump, and then remote learning and pandemic. Anyway, she got back in touch and said, do you still want your jumper? And I was like, yes. And by that stage I had my gorgeous cover, and I was like, this is really awkward and weird, but I just want something to, you know, remind myself that in the midst of this crazy pandemic year, I did this thing. I released this book. This is my book. You know, here's the colors. Maybe you could reference it somehow.
It's so spectacular.
Which is so gorgeous. And then what I
got, I know, I saw that on Instagram as well.
It's just
this is a handmade face mask. That is
the Motherfault face mask. It's just, it's those that all I can say is get yourself a damn hot cover, and then people will want to make things with it. It's really fun.
And so what else is things coming up?
So I did just, we were just saying before we started recording that I have been starting to do some podcast interviews, which, well, isn't the shoe on the other foot now? Because as you know, people have often said to us, I don't know how you made me say all that stuff. Like, or, oh my gosh, I can't bear to listen back to it. What did I say? Well, I got off the interview and was like, oh shit, what did I say?
I feel like the more candid a person is, though, the more interesting it is for the listener.
It's true. Well, you can definitely expect candor from me. Well, in that one. Anyway, I may put up more.
Right, Booktopia, write that down.
But it's fun, it's lovely, but it's all that same stuff. You know, it's a bizarre and kind of a constructed world when you're in book promo, because the other things that are surrounding me right now, like my entire desk here is covered with the stuff I'm working on for book three. So that flux, you know, the give and take of going in and giving your all and remembering, I have to go back and look through I've been looking at photos of Musk and all that stuff that, you know, of all the times that we've been there, and every single one of those times.
This is where our writer's retreat is.
Yeah, to try and remember, okay, what did it feel like to be in the book? And people ask such generous and lovely questions. Anyway, it's lovely. It's a bit mad trying to do it with remote learning and two children and the rest of it. But besides that, you know.
Are you even bothering with the specialist?
No, but classes. Then we got in trouble because then on like the Monday check-in, it's like, you know, and what did you all do for your specialist on Friday?
I know. How's Italian like, going?
What did we do for art? And me like, we didn't do art.
We should just not have to do it. Like, seriously, art, Italian, PE, take a break. Just you're on holidays.
Take a break.
Not going to happen. But we're meant to be continuing on a note of positivity.
Right, positivity. What have you got? Positive things. Tell me your positive things.
Teeny tiny positive things. Yep. One, which is bringing me great joy, and if I was Marie Kondoing my house, it would be one of the few things left in it, is one of the good things that my mum actually sent me in the mail, a real proper sticky tape dispenser. So the sort of sticky tape dispenser your own mother probably had. Yeah.
It's so heavy.
She's like hang the expense with the mail at the moment. We are both spending a fortune on postage. But this is like a sizable sticky tape dispenser with an extra thick sticky tape on it. It's on my desk. No one else is allowed to use it. I just need a pair of good scissors now. Oh. And like, I am set. It's really so good.
I considered stealing mum and dad's one from their house because I don't think they make them like they used to, sticky tape dispensers.
Why was I making do with one of those little plastic ones that comes apart at the edges? And
I like public service announcements that have come out of lockdown, especially from you, Catherine. I like this one now. Get yourself a damn good
You won't tape. Regret it. And you'll only buy one in your whole life. It's worth it. You are worth good sticky tape.
Okay, great. Excellent. So this is kid theme, kids in lockdown theme. We have a reserve behind where we live, which is very lovely. And I know not everyone's in that position. But one of our gorgeous neighbours has created this track through the bush, kind of like bush bashed through the bush, And what is amazing about it, and I know people have been kind of, I've seen people talking about this on social media and in the news about like finding new spaces within your 5 kilometre boundary that we're allowed to go. And just being at this different angle, it's quite a steep hill behind us. So just being at this different angle, it is like disappearing into the bush. It is amazing. And it's been so delightful for my brain. And then once you've kind of bush bashed through on this track and jumped over the trees and the rocks and the little kind of creeks that are through the reserve, when you get to the top, you look out and basically you can the city is right on our skyline. Like, it's a long way away, but you know, you can feel like just giving the whole place a big old hug. It's pretty nice.
Aww.
We've been hanging out in the reserve. What about you? Another tiny good theme. Have you got a kid theme?
Another tiny good one. Kid theme, the fairy garden. So I think every parent with smallish children is searching for something that will occupy the child's time at the same time requiring no effort on behalf of the parent.
Absolutely.
That's where the fairy garden comes in. So I don't even know how it started, but Carney bought... I feel like I should whisper. Carney bought a bunch of little...
Turn it off if you're listening in the car with children.
Bought a bunch of little $2 fairies from the shop.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Anyway, so we had them. They're hidden in a secret spot. And then one afternoon we went out, we sprinkled glitter in a particular spot in the garden that would become the fairy garden. And overnight... a fairy arrived.
Oh my gosh.
So the kids got up in the morning, checked the garden, there's a fairy there. And so now we have this very, very elaborate and ever evolving fairy garden. And basically, a fairy only comes if you put a lot of love into that garden. So if you spend a lot of time arranging rocks, tying ribbons to leaves, maybe you have a special box, a picture.
But then what about if all that happens and still the fairy, because maybe the fairy had a glass too much of wine last night or was watching Netflix too long?
Well, the fairy can't come too often anyway. So there's lots of reasons that a fairy might get waylaid. Maybe it's at someone else's house that night.
Right.
Yep. But it's brought us a lot of time, basically. It's all about time.
I'm so glad. That's a good one. My next tiny thing, I don't know, did I already recommend this last week, is this new book that I've been reading, which is hidden under all the piles here, which Sarah Centilli's recommended in the Word Cave. It's called The Creative Habit.
I love
that. She is this incredible, it's kind of like a creativity handbook, and she's a choreographer. So I always love, it's why I think I loved that other one about creativity, whose name I've forgotten, that Charlotte recommended. The Jerry Saltz one.
Oh, I knew you were going to say that. I just saw a bit Jerry from that interview.
He put you off.
Jerry.
But I love it when it's an artist working in another discipline talking about their discipline, and then you can do the crossover to your own. I really like that little bit of disconnect, which doesn't feel so much like you must do what this writer says. And it's terrific. It's got exercises in it. We'll put a link in there, but I really recommend it. So I've been kind of reading for 5 minutes in the morning when I come in for my early morning writing session, and then jumping straight in, and it's really good. Highly recommend.
I feel like if you're the recommendation I'll give on the back of that is like the similarities and differences between us summed up. So the one I was going to recommend, also a book, is Tools of Titans by Tim Ferriss, which it's oh my God, I'm absolutely obsessed with it. They were giving it away on Audible. I don't know, they must give away a free Audible book a month. So originally I downloaded it, but it's not one to listen to. It's definitely one to read. It's based on the many, many podcast interviews he's done as part of his podcast. But basically each person in it, and there would be a couple of hundred people in it.
Wowzers.
People at the top of their game in business, in health, performers. BJ Novick, who's a writer on The Office, is in it. And so they might have 2 pages, they might have 4 pages, but it's just their responses, their best responses to certain questions. So the questions might be about morning routine, it might be about how they think about things, what they eat, what the best $100 they've ever spent. Like, it just is, and it's exactly what you're saying around that cross-pollination, where it's someone who's not doing exactly what you're doing, but it's fabulous. It is, you just pick it up. It's not a book that you need to read from start to finish. There's some fabulous people in it. One of the ones I've really loved, and I've now gone and listened to him be interviewed by Tim Ferriss on the Tim Ferriss podcast, is Scott Adams, who did Dilbert. Fascinating guy, like random, but really, really interesting, really sort of scientific-y type mind. But one of the things he talks about is, in terms of that works for success, is that it's really, really difficult to be the best at something. So to be in that top 1 or 2% is incredibly, incredibly difficult. What is a lot more achievable and actually will work just as well, maybe even better, is to be in the like top 25% of two things or three things. And his take is like, you just need two specializations that you're pretty good at. So he's like, I'm reasonably funny and reasonably good at drawing. Put those together and I've got this phenomenal like cartoon that I've created that is,
it's
just really, really interesting. It's so good. Tools of Titans.
That sounds amazing. Maybe
he also does
the concept.
It's so good. He also asks people what book they give the most. And then at the end, there's like the most recommended books by this. Like, it's really, really good.
Okay,
it's perfect for lockdown. Very inspiring.
Brilliant.
Very, a bit white man, but that's my main critique.
We have just one more bonus good thing this week, Catherine. We are going to reveal the identity of our brand new agony aunt.
That's right. This person is the award-winning author of 7 novels and 2 works of nonfiction. They are a member of the Order of Australia for Significant Services to Literature, one of Australian Financial Review's 100 Women of Influence.
Big clue right there.
The inaugural Judy Harris Writer-in-Residence at the Charles Perkins Centre podcaster. Welcome back to the First Time Podcast, Charlotte Wood.
Yahoo! Charlotte Wood, you're here. You're back on the First Time Podcast.
I am. I'm excited.
We're very excited to have you. Can you please tell us, because you admitted to us that you have a not-so-secret fantasy about being an agony aunt. Can you tell us?
I have always harboured this fantasy. It's not, not really, because I said to my husband the other week, I've always wanted to be an agony aunt. And he said, you, about what? I was like, just like etiquette. And it's like... Actually, it'd be really bad at that. So it's sort of bringing together my my advice columnist fantasies, and the fact that I get asked for little bits of advice here and there quite a bit from young writers like yourselves, and I just thought it could be a really fun way of maybe, because I haven't got time to answer all the queries I get in email and via social media and stuff, so I just thought it could be fun.
Maybe to start off with, to give listeners a low threshold to begin from, what's the worst advice you've ever given anyone in relation to writing?
The worst advice? Catherine, I've only ever given excellent advice. I'm actually very poor at predicting which books will be published and which won't. And I'm very poor at predicting which books will be a smash hit and which books won't. So I have never actually told anyone your book's going to be a smash hit, but
why
I have sort of quietly walked away from people thinking, well, that's never going to be published, and then it goes on to be a massive world smash hit. So I would be a terrible, terrible publisher. But I think I've been around a long time in the publishing industry as a writer, so hopefully I have something to offer.
Well, we'll flip it. What is the best advice you think you've given?
God. I think the best advice I've given is not so much about career stuff, but it's about following your creative truth, I suppose. I think the best advice I've given is about the ways to get happiness from writing, which is not about other people's approval or the publishing process or, you know, all the things that we sort of desperately clamber after when we start out. You know, the longer you go on, the more you realise that the only really solid satisfaction and happiness comes from doing the writing. And it sounds really sort of naff to say that, but you kind of, the more you go on, the more you know that's really true. So you have to find your own happiness is the wrong word, but, you know, fulfillment from the process itself. And then there are ways to behave in the publishing world. And I've seen people make kind of cringy mistakes in a way that you want to go, no, don't do that. So hopefully doing some of these questions might help people in that regard.
Charlotte, if you had an opportunity to ask anyone a writing-related question, who would you ask and what would you ask them?
Jeez, you are springing these on me. Sorry. I would ask.
Would it be about where they got their ideas?
Yeah, it'll be whether they use a pen or a typewriter. I think I might ask someone like Anne Enright. Most of my questions will be about holding your nerve as a writer. You know, when you, especially if you do have a bit of success, then holding your nerve after that to just go and do what you want, even if you think, well, it's going to upset those people who were happy with me last time. So people like Anne Enright, Elizabeth Strout, my new favourite writer, Joan Silber, or Sigrun Nunez. I think she's amazing. I think they're usually, my kind of angsty things are about holding your nerve in terms of maybe changing form or that sort of stuff. But I've also learned a lot myself now about that, I think.
All right, we're going to set some parameters. Charlotte, is there anything that you won't answer?
I don't know that there is, but, you know, maybe I'll know when I get the question. Oh, my God, I can't answer that. I wouldn't answer anything really deeply personal about myself. But, and I guess I thought it would be useful to not so much talk about craft stuff, because there's a lot of teaching and stuff out there. I suppose the areas that I think are not so much addressed publicly are the kinds of, like this first question we have is brilliant because it's one that comes up all the time.
Great.
So kind of career stuff, but not necessarily in terms of, you know, how do I write a blockbuster, you know, international bestseller, because I wouldn't have a clue, but about, I guess, trusting different stages of the process, how to work with certain people within the kind of publishing world, I guess, how to behave as a writer in the publishing world is kind of interesting to me. And it's stuff that I wish that someone had kind of told me when I was starting out. So maybe, but, you know, I don't think anything is strictly off limits, but maybe there will be, and we'll know when we get it.
All right. We do have our first question, but just to recap for listeners, you can email us your questions at hosts@thefirsttimepodcast.com. We already have a couple of questions up our sleeve. The first one is this. I have an agent with a big reputation, but being a little fish, I'm getting the impression I don't figure as a priority. I've asked myself if I'm being a diva and remind myself I'm lucky to have an agent at all. But a lot of the email responses I get make it clear that either previous conversations went unread or have been forgotten. I work really hard on writing outside of a demanding full-time job and feel as though I'm the one making all the effort. If I'm honest, I don't feel as though I have a champion in my corner. What would you do?
Well, this is a great question from someone who I'm going to call Little Fish, because I think it possibly we've all felt like this at some point. And the initial, you know, my first sort of knee-jerk response is to say, well, yes, that's outrageous. You have to dump your agent and find a new one. And, you know, that might actually be the right course of action in the end. But I thought before you do this, there might be a few things to just step back and consider. And the first one, the big question here is about what it is that you're actually expecting from an agent. And I'm going to talk sort of generally for a bit about this, not just in Little Fish's case, but for all of us, because you know, years ago, and I don't know if this is changing at all, I kind of hope it is, but, you know, you've got an agent, but it was never very clear. No one ever said what you can expect and what you should not expect from your agent in this relationship. You know, it's really hard to get an agent, and it often turns out that a new writer is kind of so desperate to get an agent that they'll just, if someone says yes and they go, great, and then, but they don't really know what it is that they're entering into with this relationship. So I also think there's been a fair bit of romanticism about the author-agent relationship, as there is romanticism about every single bit of the writer's life, as we know. So this can lead to a sort of mismatch of expectations. And again, I'm not talking about little fish in this case, but just I'll talk generally and then come back to little fish's particular question here. So I thought maybe I'd set out first what my relationship is like with my agent. He's Jenny Darling. She was a fantastic agent. And after sort of 15 years of working together, we are now quite good friends. But I have to say that for around about the first probably 10 years, we had a very, very strictly business-like relationship that was kind of silent a lot of the time. We pretty much had no contact outside that very short period of selling a book. And that was usually for, you know, five books or whatever it was up to that point, up till 10 years. It was very short because the books weren't going to auction. They were just going to one publisher who, thank God, accepted them each time. They made an offer, we accepted. You know, it was a pretty brief period of interaction. So every few years, basically, we'd have a flurry of emails and phone calls and then an occasional update about all the rejections coming in from overseas. And that was kind of it. We didn't have coffee together. We didn't have dinner. We ring each other up and chat about our lives at all. And to me, that was absolutely right. She never knew what my emotional state was. I never knew anything about her life at all outside work. And that was kind of exactly right for me. I never sent her my work in progress. Lots of people do that and lots of agents like that, but we just didn't have that kind of relationship. I would get my work as ready as I could by, you know, getting writer friends to read it. I really worked hard on it, and then I would send it to her when I thought it was ready. Sometimes we would have a difficult conversation where she would tell me it wasn't ready, and I would go away and work on it again and come back and off we'd go. So that's one thing to kind of, I guess, make clear that writers don't always have these super chatty, close relationships with their agents. Some do, some don't, but it's really quite normal not to have that, I think. There's another thing that I think it's really good for writers to understand about the kind of big sort of gap in different personalities of writers and agents. Writers, in my experience, and I'm pretty much talking about myself here, are hypersensitive, anxious, thin-skinned, nervy, a little bit bonkers. All of that is not to say that we're not also extremely tough and resilient and amazing, imaginative, fantastic people, because we are all those things. The thin-skinned side of us is really, really good for writing. It's really, really bad for everything else in your life, especially in once you get past the writing bit into the, you know, business side of publishing bit. It's really not good for that side of things. Now, agents, on the other hand, are often very blunt, sort of quite tough talking, a bit bossy, a bit blustery, very no-nonsense sorts of people. This is fantastic for doing book deals where they have to be way more confident than you are about your work. Writers are kind of renowned for being a bit scared of their agents often. And, you know, some people think that's terrible. Frankly, I think having a slightly scary agent is a really good thing, because if they're scary to you, they're also going to be a bit scary to publishers. And that's kind of what you want. You don't want to push over as an agent. But it's not, you know, it's a kind of personality type. And I'm not saying all agents are like that at all. But you want an agent who can push back against, you know, what publishers want, who's in your corner, and we'll come back to Little Fish's situation with that particular problem in a minute. But, you know, there's no use having a super sweet, lovely, friendly, loving but kind of helpless and passive agent. It's just not the right personality type for that job, which is to go out in the world and push. Some agents are both tough and pushy and loving and very kind. And actually, I think Jenny Darling is one of those people, but I didn't know that for a long time because we had this very, very businesslike relationship. And it took a long time for us to develop this much sort of easier kind of friendship. But in general, personally, I think your agent is not the person to go to for reassurance, morale boosting, the kind of emotional support that I get from my writer friends. You know, it sort of feels a bit embarrassing to admit that I do need lots of reassurance, and, you know, I'm not a confident person. I'm certainly not confident in my writing. But I don't seek that sort of hand-holding out from my agent or my publisher. I just, you know, it might be kind of old-fashioned, but I feel like there's a real division of labour between my personal life and my professional life. And the emotional stuff is in the personal life, even if it's to do with writing, and I don't exhibit it in my professional life. So reiterating, this is not what I think Little Fish is saying here, because Little Fish does sound to me really quite clear and professional. So back to Little Fish. You have this agent, but clearly the two of you have different ideas about what to expect from this in terms of the amount of contact, maybe the nature of that contact. First thing I'd probably do is ask around your writing mates about how their relationships with their agents work, especially the thing about the number of, you know, how often are they in touch, what sort of things do they talk about, etc. And that's to kind of just gauge whether what you're feeling is in alignment with, you know, other people in your sort of stage of development as a writer in the same sort of area of same genres, for want of another better word. So if you do that, you might think, oh, actually nobody has this kind of contact that I'm wanting. Mm. Or you might think it'll just help you to gauge where you are in relation to other writers. So that's one thing to do. So then once you do that, and you think, okay, no, I'm right, I still am not getting, you know, what is a reasonable professional sort of level of care and communication from my agent, then that's the time to take a deep breath and initiate a big grown-up conversation with your agent. Now, when I hear that, I think, oh, conflict, scary. Who wants to do it? Nobody wants to do it. But, you know, you have to do it because you're a grown-up. And if you don't do it, your agent may have absolutely no idea that you've got this issue with them at all, even if they should have an idea. You know, they've all got lots of clients, especially if you say this agent has a big reputation. They've probably got a lot of clients. And if you're early in your career, we are all, you know, nobodies until we write a book that makes us a somebody, you know. So, but basically your behaviour over a long period of time will stand you in good stead for good relationships in the publishing world. So what I would do in this case is to get in touch and just say in a really neutral, grown-up, non-defensive, but also, you know, courteously assertive way, can we make time for a meeting, a phone call or whatever, about where things are at with my book and my career, and for me to get some clarity from you about the period ahead, and just to clarify my understanding of what our roles are in relation to this work. Presumably the agent will say, okay, sure. Now, if they don't, we'll come to that in a second. But before that conversation, I'd make a really clear list of what you think the problems are. I'd really write down what are the issues here constructively. And I would have those notes while I was in, even if it was a face-to-face meeting, just so I knew that I was covering all the issues that I needed to discuss and sort of tick them off as I go. It'll also strengthen your position by helping you to be really clear and professional and concise. And actually in writing these things down, you might discover that you're actually a bit vague about what you do want, you know. So it will really help you to be very clear about what it is that you want from them. So, and just to try and clarify in general, what can I expect from you? What should I not expect from you? And what do you expect from me? Just to be very sort of clear and professional about it. You don't need to get defensive. You don't need to get sort of be really good if you didn't get emotional. That can be very hard, but, you know, it's a business professional relationship. This person is not your best friend or your mother or whatever. So one thing that Little Fish says, this is an agent with a big reputation. So that could mean that you are just really low on the priority list and that they have all the power. It could mean they have a lot of high earning clients way ahead of you on the priority in the pecking order, as you say. That doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing, because this means this is the kind of agent who has this sort of power in the publishing world, which is a good thing. But if you feel that you are never going to be listened to and you are just permanently disregarded, then yes, it's a real problem. And it definitely does happen. So after you have that conversation, you'll either feel, you know, better or worse. And if it's clear that this relationship still isn't going to work, then then there's a time to decide, okay, I'm going to, start looking around for another agent. I don't know if I should go on about then looking for another agent or if that's going to take too long.
No, that's all right.
I think that's good.
Yeah. Go.
I think it's a nice, juicy question.
Yeah, it is. It's great.
Yeah, it's a big question. The other one I'm much quicker at. So after this meeting, if you still get the brush off or you feel that you're really not being respected or listened to, then I think you are entitled to step away from that agent and look for a new one. I've never actually done this myself because I haven't needed to. But one thing I would suggest is that it's really good to look at agents in a really strategic but also honourable way and be quite open with the agent that you're seeking about the fact that you already have an agent but you think it's time to separate from them. Obviously, this is all highly confidential. Some people are very honourable and they end that relationship before looking for a new one. I don't really know what the etiquette is on that, but I think a lot of agents would have clients that come straight from one agent to another. The first thing to do is do not bitch about your current agent to the new one. You know, it's like any kind of job interview situation where if you whinge and moan about your present boss, they think, well, it's going to be me one day. So it's just not professional. You could just say, look, you feel that you've got different priorities or just some kind of euphemism like that, and they'll read between the lines and that'll be fine. The other thing to remember is that agents in Australia all know each other. The whole publishing industry all knows each other. So if you sort of behave unprofessionally with one, word gets around. So you just need to be really careful about your just sort of courteous and professional behaviour. You just go a long way in this whole industry with a bit of humility and a lot of professionalism. When you're looking for a new agent, the first thing I would do is look at their client list and see whether you sort of fit in with the kind of stuff they represent, and also to make sure they're reputable and experienced. If you know any of their clients or you have maybe a mutual friend in common, you can get in touch with them and say, look, could I have a confidential chat with you about how well you feel like your relationship, what kind of approach does this agent have, to see, because if you think, well, they actually just sound like the same as my last one, then maybe there's no reason to change. So only you can really work that out. Another thing to note is that anyone can call themselves an agent, but if you go with someone who is really new to the game or the industry, you've got to be prepared for them to just not have the kind of clout that this big name agent presumably does have. But I also do feel that you can get lost in a big agency if you're a new writer. So it's a reasonable thing to ask. I've had writers say to me, oh, I'm really excited, I've got this new agent. And then they tell you who it is and I'm thinking, I don't think they're an agent. I think they're a nice person who knows a few publishers, but they don't have expertise in negotiating contracts. They've never actually done a book deal before. Being a literary agent has an extremely high level of expertise. It's not just about handing a book to a publisher. There's a whole heap of stuff, legal contracts, there's international, sub-agents and things involved. There's a whole film deals, or like millions of different kinds of contracts. It's incredibly complicated. So I would not go with an agent who has never done any of that stuff before, because they're going to be learning on your book. And that's not something you want to do. So I guess to summarise the whole thing, the main points will be to become clear what the agent-author relationship is about, and to see if you can bring your expectations into alignment with theirs by having this grown-up professional conversation. They might end up saying, look, I really love your work. I really love what you're doing. I just can't answer 3 emails a week, Or they might say, what are you worried about how dare you, in which case, you know, then you know that you're not in the right place. Then quietly, if you can't resolve it quietly, look around for another agent who you think you can work with. And when you get a new agent, or when you're talking to a new agent, really try and get some clarity on this thing of what you can expect and what you can't expect, what they want from you, what they don't want from you. But I think just don't romanticize the relationship into some heavenly thing where you get to ring each other up all the time and talk about your writing, because it just, in my experience with two different agents, doesn't happen and is not reasonable to expect. And then when you do, you know, find a new agent, get someone with experience, because otherwise you could end up with the same problem with someone who's got less experience than your big name agent. And probably the last thing I will always say in any of these conversations is that the job of a writer is to write. And if you're spending more time being worried about your agent than you are spending on your writing, then that's something to, you know, recalibrate.
You can find the show notes for this episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. If you're feeling so inclined, we would love for you to leave us a review wherever you listen. This helps other people find us.
Get in touch with us via the contact page on our website, or connect with the entire First Time gang on Twitter or Instagram at The First Time Pod. And don't forget, you can support us via Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We recorded this episode at Kathleen Syme Library on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons.